Good to see all of you here tonight. There's a lot of places you could be on a cool, semi-rainy Tuesday night, but you've chosen to be here, and I know I'm grateful for that. And my prayer is that our time together tonight will be profitable. As a dirty joke on some of his friends, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the man who invented Sherlock Holmes, had about a dozen friends he sent an anonymous letter to one day. They all received it at the same time. And this letter said, "All is discovered. Flee the country." Before the day was over, all 12 people had left. What is it about this abiding sense of guilt that humans have? You know, I don't know if they were actually guilty of something. Apparently they thought they were, and they acted on it. But there seems to be this universal idea, and I actually kind of know the answer to why, but there is this constant aspect of guilt that most human beings feel. In the book, Whatever Became of Sin, written by Dr. Carl Menninger, he opens the book talking about a man, I believe was in Chicago in the 70s. He was downtown in Chicago, one of the busiest intersections. He was there at lunchtime. And the man just stood there on the corner, and somebody would walk by, and he would point at them and say, "Guilty." And somebody else would walk by, and he would point at them and say, "Guilty." And he did that for quite a while there on that street corner. And there were people who kind of noticed this, and they started talking among themselves, and some of them thought to themselves, "Guilty of what?" But other people said, "How did he know?" There is this constant abiding sense of guilt. And I know why we do that. It's because God made us that way. We have what God put in us called a conscience. A conscience is simply God's way of reminding us that when we feel do something wrong, we really ought to feel badly about it. Now, part of the problem with human existence is that many people have trained themselves to feel absolutely nothing when they do something wrong. And that creates a set of problems all of its own. I want us to look at a psalm tonight, Psalm number 32. If you have your Bibles, please turn there. Psalm number 32. Let's just begin by reading the psalm together. Psalm 32 says, "How blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. How blessed is the man to whom the Lord does not impute iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no deceit. When I kept silent about my sin, my body wasted away through my groaning all day long. For night and day your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was drained away as with the fever heat of summer. I acknowledged my sin to you, and my iniquity I did not hide. And I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. Therefore, let everyone who is godly pray to you in a time when you may be found. Surely in a flood of great waters they will not reach him. You are my hiding place. You preserve me from trouble. You surround me with songs of deliverance. I will instruct you and teach you in the way which you should go. I will counsel you with my eye upon you. Do not be as the horse or as the mule which have no understanding, whose trappings include bit and bridle to hold them in check. Otherwise they will not come near to you. Many are the sorrows of the wicked, but he who trusts in the Lord, loving kindness shall surround him. Be glad in the Lord and rejoice, you righteous ones, and shout for joy, all you who are upright in heart." So that then is the text of Psalm 32. Psalm 32, if you look at the top, at the headings, it just says, "of David." Literally it says, "of David." Some translations say, just kind of add a couple of words, "a psalm of David." But we have reason to believe that this was indeed one of David's psalms. And it says it is a maskil. A maskil is a devout meditation on something. And if you'll notice, the psalm begins with two words that we've seen already in our studies this week: "how blessed." When a psalm begins with that phrase, most of the time it's what we would call a wisdom psalm or a didactic psalm. It's a psalm intended for us to teach us about something by making us meditate on some particular theme. You see it at the beginning of Psalms in Psalm number 1. We saw it last night in Psalm 128. When a psalm says, how blessed, what it's telling us is, we're going to meditate for a while on a particular subject. Well, what this psalm meditates on is the subject of sin and forgiveness. And it deals in some ways, not exclusively, but in some ways with the emotional aspects of forgiveness. And so I titled this lesson, how does forgiveness feel? I guess I could give you the short answer, we'd go home. Forgiveness feels really good. But it's a little bit more complex than that, and so I want us to look at what David has to say about this. Psalm 32 is a companion psalm, I believe, to Psalm 51. As I just pointed out, it's a maskil or a devout meditation. It's written by David. And that is a key. I believe that this psalm and Psalm 51 were both written in the aftermath of his sin with Bathsheba. If you go back to 2 Samuel chapter 11 and 12, really at the height of his imperial career, he makes a serious mistake by sleeping with another man's wife. He commits adultery. He sleeps with the wife of Uriah the Hittite, and she gets pregnant. And you remember the whole story about the cover-up, and he tries to make it look like it's really Uriah's son, but it's not. He plots against Uriah and commits murder, and finally he's confronted by Nathan the prophet. Well, when everything comes to light, you know, David just very freely admits, you know, I did wrong, although he freely admits it after about a year. But he's confronted with his sin, he admits it, and then the rest of the story of David is really a tragic one. But I believe that Psalm 51 and Psalm 32 were both written in the wake of that sin. But I believe that they were written, I think, at two different times for two different purposes. Turn with me, if you will, to Psalm 51. I believe that Psalm 51 was probably written first of the two. Psalm 51 is a prayer to God. It is a heart-wrenching prayer. It is a very heartfelt prayer. It is a prayer where he is begging for God's forgiveness. And in fact, the title of this, if you look at the title of Psalm 51 for the choir director of Psalm of David, when Nathan the prophet came to him after he had gone into Bathsheba. So that gives us a time frame for this. I believe this is what he wrote as a type of confession to God after he sinned. He confessed his sin, he understood that God had forgiven him, and he writes this psalm to simply confess to God, yes, in fact, I have sinned. So you could think of Psalm 51 as his confessional. Psalm 32, though, is talking about forgiveness. Now, it doesn't specifically name the setting of the sin with Bathsheba, but he is talking about the blessedness of forgiveness. And I think this psalm was probably written sometime later, after he had time to meditate on what he had done, the grievous sin that he had done, and the enormity of God's forgiveness. So I think they both address the same sin, but I think Psalm 32 is probably written a little bit later for the purpose of meditating on what it means to be forgiven of transgression. Now, with that in mind, I think the psalm basically falls into three parts. I'm going to give you this picture first. The first part of it is David's experience of both sin and forgiveness, the first five verses. Then we have David's exhortation to his readers that here's what you need to do instead of doing what I did. And then finally, David's exultation over this joy of forgiveness. So that's the basic outline of the psalm. Let's begin by looking at this first section where it talks about David's experience. You could say it's either his experience of sin or his experience of forgiveness. I think it's interesting, I'll talk about this a little bit more, that he begins by describing what forgiveness is. He says, how blessed is the man whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. How blessed is the man to whom the Lord does not impute iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no deceit. He gives us four different descriptions of what forgiveness is. And this is an example of what I talked about Sunday. It's an example of parallelism where he just builds on an idea. How blessed is the man, he says, whose transgression is forgiven. Transgression is the idea of crossing a boundary. It's the idea of rebelling against someone, turning away from God. And then the word forgiven involves the idea of taking away something or removing something. So how blessed is the one whose rebellion has been removed. And then secondly, he says, how blessed is the one whose sin is covered. Sin Both in the Old and New Testament, the words that are used imply missing the mark. It implies the idea of falling short of some sort of goal or standard. And how blessed is the one whose sin is covered. That word simply means concealed. It carries the idea of making something invisible or almost making something disappear. So how blessed is the one who falls short and that is concealed or hidden by God. Then he says, how blessed is the one whose iniquity is not imputed. The word iniquity means an offense or a perversion of something. I think that in itself is an interesting concept. We need to understand that Satan is genius at sin. Sin is frequently something that may be right in itself, but used in the wrong way. Is it wrong for a man and a woman to have sex? Absolutely not. But if you're not married to them, that's a real problem. And that was the problem with David. He slept with someone that he was not married to. In fact, he was already married. She was already married. There's a problem there. And in that case, the sex was perverted because it was not in the right context. A lot of things that we do in our lives may be perfectly fine, but you put it in the wrong context, there's a problem. You know, fire in a fireplace is a really good thing. Fire in the middle of your living room is not a good thing. And sin is the same way. And this word iniquity, I think, conveys the idea not just of offense, but perhaps a perversity that accompanies sin so often. How blessed is the man whose iniquity is not imputed. To impute something means that you charge it to someone's account. It's very much an accounting term. You understand this. When you go and you use your credit card, that charge has been imputed to your account. It's been reckoned to your account. You now owe a debt. And frequently sin in the Bible is treated like a debt. You have incurred a debt. That debt has to be paid. Forgiveness is the transaction where God erases the debt. And then finally he says, how blessed is the one in whom there is no deceit, in whose spirit there is no deceit. Deceit means that you use guile on people. Deceit is the idea that you hide things from people. You present one thing and you're actually hiding something else. So how blessed is the one who is not that kind of person. What he gives us here is four pictures of forgiveness. What is forgiveness? It is the removal of something. It is the covering of something. It is the cancellation of something. And I really like that last one where he says, in whose spirit there is no deceit, because he gets away from the sin itself and the transaction of sin, and he gets to the transformation and reformation of the person. Forgiveness is ultimately a transformation. A lot of times when we ask for God to forgive us, what we're asking is, God, please don't remember that blunder that I made. But let me tell you something else we need to ask for too, is that God will change me so that I don't make that mistake again. That God will transform me so that no longer has an appeal to me. That God will work something in my life. He will take His power, apply it to me, so that I'm not ever going to make that mistake again. It is one thing to be forgiven. It's another thing to be forgiven and then act like it doesn't matter. When we are forgiven, that should be a powerful motive to try to do better. And I think that all four of these pictures here in verses 1 and 2 describe complete forgiveness as well as the transformation of our character that should go along with that. Someone has said that the only way to remove cobwebs is to get rid of the spider. And the only way to get rid of guilt is to get rid of the sin that causes it. So God can remove that, but we've got to do something about it too by asking for His help in changing our character. Now the second thing he talks about is the burden of sin. And again, I think it's interesting. He could have started out by talking about what sin did to him. But instead, he talks about what God did to him in terms of forgiveness. Let's look now at this second aspect. What was the burden of sin? How did he describe what he felt like after he sinned? When I kept silent about my sin, my body wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was drained away as with the fever heat of summer. Now, I think that's interesting. Verses 3 and 4, he's describing how sin feels. Now, a lot of times we don't think about that. We think maybe, again, we have this guilt, but we can't quite put our finger on it. You know, there is an emotional component. There is a feeling component to sin and transgression. You know, I asked the question at the beginning of the lesson, how does forgiveness feel? Forgiveness feels good because sin feels so bad. Now, we need to be cautious that we don't make the feelings the sum total of what forgiveness is. It's more than that. But we can't ignore those feelings sometimes, and sometimes those feelings of guilt can be a healthy thing because they may point us to some problems. You know, when we go to the doctor, "Doctor, I don't feel good." What does he say? "Well, too bad for you. Feelings don't count. Get out of my office." He'll say, "Well, in what way do you not feel good?" "Well, whenever I take a step, my knee wobbles and I fall down." "Well, then you got a knee problem." Brilliant analysis there. But we understand the place of feelings in physical health. We understand the place of feelings in a lot of things. There is a place for feeling in a discussion of sin, and that's exactly what David does. How did he feel about sin? "When I kept silent about it, my body wasted away." I think that is very much a reference to his sin in 2 Samuel chapters 11 and 12. Remember, he conjures up this great cover-up. He's going to hide the fact that he slept with Uriah's wife, that he got her pregnant, and that it really wasn't Uriah's child after all. It was his. And he has this elaborate cover-up thing. Finally, he murders the man. And he's going to help that poor grieving widow, so he's going to make her his wife. And a few months later, out comes the baby, and everybody's none the wiser. Everybody knew about it. David tried to hide it. And it's after the child is born that Nathan confronts him. Remember, the child gets sick, and he dies, and Nathan confronts him. So obviously this takes place about a year after the sin is perpetuated. And quite literally, he kept silent about his sin. He tried to hide it. But don't think he was successful at it. God knew it. But David was miserable. "When I kept silent about my sin, what happened? My body wasted away through my groaning all day long." I have told my kids this, and I have preached this from the pulpit, and I will say it every day if I have to. When you sin, I hope you feel lousy. I hope you feel miserable because you deserve to, and God intends for you to feel bad about it. That's the function of the conscience. I do something that I know is wrong. I hope you feel lousy. Because here's what happens. If you get to a point where you don't feel lousy about it anymore, you've lost your conscience, and that's a serious thing. God designed us to feel bad when we sin. And David said, "It's just like my body is wasting away." And then I love the description, verse 4, "For day and night your hand was heavy upon me." Have you ever felt burdened? Why, that person has the weight of the world on them, we say. Well, sometimes those burdens come from our mistakes, from doing things that we know are wrong. If you've ever sinned and felt bad about it, isn't that an accurate description? You felt like something was just pressing down on you? Absolutely. That's the burden of sin. And then he goes on to say, "My vitality was drained away as with the fever heat of summer." Does it get hot in Kansas? How do you feel in the middle of July or first part of August and the sun's out all day long and it's dry as a bone? How bad is the humidity here? I really don't remember. Is it, anyway, think about 105 degrees outside. Don't you just want to go out and walk around in that? Most of us want to sit inside on the couch and sip something cold. We want the air conditioner running. Heat drains your body. You know how it's what it's like to be in the hot summer heat. And he says, that's just what sin felt like. I just wanted to sit down and melt. So what he's describing here are the consequences of sin. His body wasted away, the Lord's heavy hand was upon him, and he had no vitality. But you know what? This is not the only place in the Bible that talks about some of the physical consequences of sin. Look in Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs chapter 3, verse 8. Verse 7. "Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn away from evil. It will be healing to your body and refreshment to your bones." I believe that is very literally true. And again, I've dealt with people before, and I'm sure you have, and I know in my own life there have been times I have done some things I knew was wrong, and I felt awful until I got rid of the sin. And it's like you're just a new man all over again. That's a biblical concept, that there can be physical consequences to sin, emotional consequences as well. Psalm 38, another psalm that deals with this. Psalm 38. There is no soundness in my flesh because of your indignation. There is no health in my bones because of my sin. When we sin, we ought to feel lousy. And there is plenty of attestation in the Scriptures about that notion. There should be emotional consequences to sin. Again, we ought to feel bad not just physically, but we just don't have it together emotionally. Jeremiah chapter 6, verse 15, Jeremiah asked the question. He said, were they ashamed of the abomination which they had done? He said, no, they were not ashamed at all. They didn't even know how to blush. If you do something wrong and you get caught, most people turn red. You know why? That's God's way of saying, you blew it. You blew it. It's His version of a highlighter in your spiritual life. He wants you to shine bright, shiny red. That's an emotional consequence to sin. And of course, there is the spiritual consequence to sin. When we sin, we're separated from God. He talked here in Psalm 32 about the heavy hand of God upon him. God was against him. Should have been, in view of what David did. So the Bible frequently talks about consequences of sin, and the only consequence of sin is not just hell. That's lousy, that's bad, that's horrible. But there are consequences here and now. We could go on and on about the consequences. There are consequences in your relationships. Consequences in relationships. You lie to people, the relationships break down. You treat people like dirt, the relationships break down. There can be consequences at work. Go to work, do absolutely nothing all day, be uncooperative, be lazy. Don't be surprised if you get fired. There are consequences to our behavior. And again, a piece of advice I give my kids pretty frequently is, kids, you can do anything you want. You can choose anything you want. You can choose sin, you can choose righteousness. You can do anything you want to do. But you cannot at all choose the consequences. You are free to make any choice you want, but you're not free to determine what the consequences are. That is built into the equation. And so it is with sin and moral living. And finally here, he talks about the beginning of his relief. Look at verse 5. I acknowledged my sin to you, and my iniquity I did not hide. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave me of the guilt of my sin. That's a perfect description of what happens with his sin with Bathsheba. He was finally confronted. He stewed on it for a long time, maybe even thought, okay, I finally got away with it. And Nathan brought him back down to earth, confronted him. And he said, yes, I have sinned. And that was the beginning of relief for him. This idea that confession of sin, confession is good for the soul, people say. Confession is absolutely essential to maintain a right relationship with God. It is absolutely essential if we want to walk with Him and be in fellowship with Him. Over in the New Testament, in 1 John chapter 1, beginning in verse 8, John makes the comment, if we say that we have no sin, we are deceiving ourselves and the truth is not in us. If we confess our sins, He is faithful and righteous to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. If we say we have not sinned, we make Him a liar and His word is not in us. When I'm wrong, I need to admit it. Most of all to God, sometimes perhaps to others. Part of the problem is we get ashamed of ourselves and we think, I just can't tell anybody about this. It's like the young man who went off to college and he didn't pay too close attention to his clothes and his hygiene, and suddenly he came home one day, had no clothes to wear. He looked at every garment in his room and it was a filthy, nasty mess. He was so ashamed of it, he wrapped all of it up into one giant bundle, tied it together, threw it in the washing machine, and then was surprised that nothing got clean. The only way to get things clean is to open them up and get the detergent where it needs to go. The only way to get your spiritual life clean is to open up and let God cleanse what needs to be cleansed. As I said, it's interesting to me that he begins not with a description of how bad sin felt, but how good forgiveness felt. I think there's a motivational reason for that. Sin really feels bad, but forgiveness feels even better. And I think he wants to start by saying, there is nothing like forgiveness. There is nothing like forgiveness. As bad as sin is, and as bad as sin feels, and as bad as the consequences are, forgiveness is greater still. Sin is a serious problem. It is the problem in our universe. But God's forgiveness and grace and mercy are even greater than that. And so I think David very appropriately begins at the right spot by talking about the blessings of forgiveness. And yes, you need to understand the problem of sin as well. So that's David's experience. Now David dispenses some advice in verses 6 through 10. He says, therefore, let everyone who is godly pray to you in a time when you may be found. Surely in a flood of great waters they shall not reach him. You are my hiding place. You preserve me from trouble. You surround me with songs of deliverance. I will instruct you and teach you in the way in which you should go. I will counsel you with my eye upon you. Do not be as the horse or as the mule which have no understanding, whose trappings include bit and bridle to hold them in check. Otherwise they will not come near you. Many are the sorrows of the wicked, but he who trusts in the Lord, loving kindness will surround him. This section, verses 6 through 10, is a little bit confusing because you're not really clear in a couple of verses. Is that David speaking? Is that God speaking? And I'm not sure I've got all the answers. There appear to be a few places where I'm pretty sure David is the speaker. There's a couple of places where I'm pretty sure God is the speaker, and there's a couple of places I really don't know. So this whole section may just be more of a conversation between David and God. But the point of this section is crystal clear. Remember, this is a maskil, a devout meditation. It is also categorized as a wisdom or didactic or teaching psalm. What are we supposed to learn from David's experience of forgiveness? We're supposed to learn something from this, and I think verses 6 through 10 are David's exhortations and applications to us. Number one, he uses the idea of insurance in talking about sin. He says, therefore, let everyone who is godly pray to you in a time when you may be found. Surely in a flood of great waters they shall not reach him. When's the time to buy flood insurance? Before or after the water arrives at your doorstep? Generally, they say beforehand is a real good thing. After the flood hits, you can't get insurance. And I think that's the imagery that he's using. I don't know that the Israelites had insurance policies, but his point is, we prepare first against sin. He says, let everyone who is godly pray to you in a time when you may be found. Now, in some regards, God is always available to us. But there may be other times when he seems a little bit further away, not because he is, but because we're further away. There are times when we are less receptive to God. There are times when we are less open with God. And he says, if you want to stop this problem of sin, you need to stop it before it starts. Pray to God before the temptation arrives. Pray to God before the sin arrives. Pray to God before you make that blunder. Get that flood insurance before you are overwhelmed with temptation. So his first bit of advice is prepare beforehand. You remember in the model prayer in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from evil. And I've had people just ponder, so what does it mean? God wouldn't lead us into temptation anyway, would he? Why should I pray about that? Because he doesn't want you to get caught in it. That's not hard. That's not hard. We need to prepare beforehand, before the sin arrives. Just like preparing for a test when you were in school. You remember that. The best time to study is not 5 minutes before the exam. The best time to study is the days before, not just the night before. I know some of you did it anyway. I did it. I crammed. It may work with tests. It's lousy with sin. You don't wait till the last moment. You build up spiritual strength and resistance. And then he gives some more instruction in verse 8 and 9. And this may be God speaking to David. It may just be David speaking as the experienced sinner saying, let me tell you something. I didn't learn from this. Here's a lesson for you. It goes back to nature. I will instruct you and teach you in the way in which you should go. I will counsel you with my eye upon you. That sounds a lot like God speaking, but again, it could be David speaking. But here's his advice. Don't be like a horse or a mule. Well, what on earth does he mean by that? He says, don't be like the horse or the mule which have no understanding, whose trappings include bit and bridle to hold them in check, otherwise they'll not come near you. Don't be like a dumb animal that doesn't know where to go unless he's told. How do animals operate? I think this is the nature of the illustration. How do animals operate? Animals operate on instinct. They just do things because it's built into them. You were made for something better than that. In fact, my experience has been when it comes to morality, a lot of times if we do those things that feel right, they're probably wrong. They may be wrong. Don't know that, but we were designed for something better than instinct. We need to be unlike the animals in that we are not coerced into doing right. You know how to get a horse into a stable? You coerce him. Or you manipulate him. Or you need to do what's right because you know it's right. Human obedience should never be coerced. And then a second component of this is we should not be like animals in the sense that we are dumb, we are mindless, we are simply instinctive. We need to think about our behavior. We need to think about what's right and what's wrong. We need to think about that stuff before we ever get in these situations. That's the remarkable capacity of human beings, is that we can actually picture things before they happen and anticipate what will happen and prepare for what happens. Why do you think pilots, for example, go through all of these simulated training exercises? Because when they get in the air, that's a bad time to be looking in the owner's manual. You hope they've got it so well imagined and trained and instilled in them that they can respond, not necessarily by instinct, but by training and by thoughtfulness, by preparation ahead of time. That's the kind of pilot I want. Spiritually speaking, we need to be the same thing when it comes to sin. We have thought about this. We know what our weak points are. We know where we're going to stumble. And we do everything in our power to avoid it. And even if I can't avoid it, here's plan B. This is what I will do. I know you can't anticipate everything. Satan is a master of surprise. But Satan can't control everything. And the Bible gives us so many tools that we can use in preparing ourselves to meet these temptations and sins. The best way to avoid sin is by preparing against it. Finally, he offers an insight in verse 10. Many are the sorrows of the wicked, but he who trusts in the Lord, loving kindness shall surround him. Verse 10 is really a reflection of verses 1 through 4. What are the sorrows of the wicked? That's verse 3 and 4. Keeping silent about sin and reaping the consequences. What is the loving kindness surrounding that person? That's verses 1 and 2. So he ends it in a shorthand way like he began it, talking about the burden of sin and the blessings of forgiveness. It's interesting to me, there's a lot of people who have accurately, they're not necessarily religious people, but many people have made the observation about the idea of guilt and how if we could solve the problem of misbehavior, the problem of guilt would go away. Carl Menninger, you're familiar with the Menninger clinics here that originated here in Kansas. Carl Menninger, in his book, Whatever Became of Sin, he made the point that if he could ever convince his patients that their sins were forgiven, he said about 75% of them would leave his clinic the next day. In fact, I like that book. It's a very old book. It was written back in the 70s. If you can ever find a copy, it's an interesting read. He was talking about the psychological consequences of trying to convince ourselves that there's no such thing as sin. And he said one of the biggest barriers to mental health is lack of accountability. You know, we want to blame our mother. We want to blame our genes. We want to blame nature. We want to blame society. He said, blame yourself. Take responsibility for your actions and you'll be a whole lot happier. Wow. He figured it out. Now I could be ugly and say, and he was from Kansas, but I won't say that. No. Yep, there are people who understand the link between misbehavior and feeling bad. Eric Fromm, in his book in 1955, The Sane Society. Now, he basically viewed that individuals were the product of their societies, basically a very sociological view. He said, "It is indeed amazing that in as fundamentally an irreligious culture as ours, the sense of guilt should be so widespread and deeply rooted as it is." That's not surprising. You know why that sense of guilt is there? Because God put it there. It's the conscience at work. When we give our list of blessings that God has given to us, we ought to regularly thank God for the conscience. We ought to feel bad when we sin. And the psalm ends with simply a very simple declaration, verse 11. He goes from teaching to singing in verse 11. He says, "Be glad in the Lord and rejoice, you righteous ones. Shout for joy, all you who are upright in heart." Two things he says here are worth noticing. He wants people who are forgiven to have joy, but he also knows that the condition of that joy is moral uprightness, partly by how we live and partly when God forgives. So he wants us to be happy, but he wants us to be upright as well. So the psalm ends on a very, very affirmative kind of note. Sin is the ugliest reality that we face every day of our lives. It is the universal constant in human existence. But thanks be to God that He has given us a solution for this problem. Psalm 32 is actually quoted in the New Testament in the book of Romans. Romans chapter 4 is that great chapter in the Bible on justification by faith. And Paul said in Romans 4, he said in verse 6, "Just as David also speaks of the blessing on the man to whom God credits righteousness apart from works," and he quotes Psalm 32 verses 1 and 2, Romans 4 verse 7 and 8 says, "Blessed are those whose lawless deeds have been forgiven, and those whose sins have been covered. Blessed is the man whose sin the Lord will not take into account." And his point was, David understood what it was to be forgiven, and it was not because the law forgave him. God took his faith and said, "I forgive you. I forgive you." There is no greater blessing than that. And not, again, just that God has canceled my debt, but also, and here's the real good news, is that God can make me whole. He can take someone whose life has been crippled and crushed and marred and ruined by sin and make your life worth living again. If there's someone here tonight who is burdened by sin, if the heavy hand of God is upon you because of your sin, if you feel like you have been drained dry because of sin, there's good news. There is forgiveness in the name of Jesus Christ. If we can help you tonight in any way, we'd invite you to come forward while we stand and sing.
At the door is standing, patiently drawing near. Entrance with any vanity, whose is the voice I hear? Sweetly the tones are falling, open the door for with me abide. Sweet. Bye.